A woman is walking across a park at dusk and sees a man lying face down in a shallow, ornamental pond. She is a trained lifeguard. She is in no hurry. She could pull him out without any risk to herself at all. She decides she does not want to be involved, walks on, and tells nobody. The man drowns. Is she guilty of anything? No, not manslaughter, not anything. English criminal law has no Good Samaritan rule, and a bare failure to act is not an actus reus. Change one fact, and the answer flips. Principles of criminal liability, the first topic in the subject, and the foundation of everything after it. Keep our lifeguard in mind. Here is the root. The two elements, and who has to prove them. Then the actus reus, the voluntary act, and when a failure to act counts instead. Then causation, in two limbs, and the intervening acts that almost never break the chain. Then mens rea, intention, recklessness, transferred malice. Then strict liability, and last, the rule that the two elements must meet. Start with the shape of it. To convict, the prosecution must normally prove two things: the actus reus, the guilty act, and the mens rea, the guilty mind. They must generally coincide in time. The prosecution proves both beyond reasonable doubt, which is the highest standard in English law. The jury must be sure, any reasonable doubt, and they must acquit. The authority is Wilmington and DPP from 1935. The trial judge directed the jury that once the prosecution had proved the killing, it was for the defendant to prove his defense. The House of Lords reversed the conviction. Viscount Sankey gave the golden thread speech. Throughout the web of English criminal law, one golden thread is always to be seen: that it is the duty of the prosecution to prove the prisoner's guilt. The defendant does carry something, though. On most offences, the burden is evidential only. Raise enough evidence to put the issue before the jury, and the prosecution must then disprove it beyond reasonable doubt. Self-defence works that way. A legal burden on the defendant is the exception, and where it exists, the standard drops to the balance of probabilities. Insanity is the classic example. Actus reus next, and it must be voluntary. The defendant must have consciously willed the movement. A man replacing a light fitting touches a live wire, his arm jerks back, and the screwdriver in his hand cuts the face of the woman steadying his ladder. The medical evidence is that he had no control over the movement, no willed act, no actus reus, no liability. Reflexes, convulsions, and acts done while unconscious are all the same, which takes you to automatism, acting without conscious control. Two kinds, and the difference decides everything. If the cause is external, a blow to the head, a spiked drink, medication in proper doses, that is sane automatism, and the defendant is simply acquitted. If the cause is internal, a disease of the mind, it is insane automatism, and the verdict is not guilty by reason of insanity under the McNaughton rules. Two limits on that. Automatism requires total destruction of voluntary control, not merely impaired control. And if the defendant brought the state on himself by taking drugs or by drinking, it is generally no defense to a crime of basic intent. A man who kills while hallucinating on LSD does not escape that way. Now, omissions, and back to our lifeguard. The general rule is that there is no liability for failing to act. You have no legal duty to be a good Samaritan. A bare omission is not an actus reus. Her training does not create a duty, nor does the ease of the rescue. nor does the fact that any decent person would have waded in. But a duty can arise, and then the failure to act becomes the actus reus. Six sources to know. Statute, where Parliament imposes the duty. Contract. A special relationship, parent and child being the clearest. A voluntary assumption of responsibility for a vulnerable person. An official position. And a dangerous situation the defendant created himself. Take contract first, because the story is the peg. Pitwood was a railway gatekeeper. He opened the gate to let a cart through, then went off to lunch without closing it. A train hit a hay cart on the crossing and killed the driver. Manslaughter. His contract created the duty, leaving the gate open breached it, and the breach caused the death. The Crown against Pitwood from 1902.
The others run the same way.
A police officer who watches a man being kicked to death outside a nightclub and then drives away is guilty of misconduct in public office. A couple who take in a bedbound relative, do a little to help, and then let her die without medical attention have assumed responsibility for her. And a squatter who falls asleep with a lit cigarette, wakes to a smouldering mattress, and simply moves to the next room has created a danger he must put right. So change one fact for our lifeguard. Put her on duty at the pool and contract supplies the duty. Make him her child and the relationship does. Have her wade in, take hold of him, and then give up, and she has assumed responsibility. Have her push him in, and she created the danger. As the facts stand, none of that is true, and there is no offence. Causation now, and for a result crime, you need both limbs. Factual causation is the but-for test. But for the defendant's act, would the result have happened as and when it did? A man poisons his mother's drink, and she dies of a heart attack before the poison does anything at all. He did not cause the death. Attempted murder, not murder. Legal causation is the operating and substantial cause test. The act must be more than a trivial contribution. It need not be the only cause, or even the main one. And a defendant who merely accelerates a death still causes it. Punch an 82-year-old man who is already dying of cancer and kill him 3 months early, and you have caused his death. Then, the intervening acts, and the headline is that they almost never break the chain. Medical treatment first. Even bad treatment does not break it, so long as the original wound is still an operating and substantial cause when the victim dies. A soldier stabbed in a barracks fight was dropped twice on the way to the medical room and given treatment described as thoroughly bad. The stabbing still caused the death. There is one famous exception from 1956 where the treatment was palpably wrong. A stab victim was given a drug he was known to be intolerant of, and large quantities of intravenous liquid, by which time the wound had all but healed. That broke the chain. It is the exception that proves the rule. And switching off a life support machine does not break the chain either. The doctors are recognizing the death the wound has caused, not causing it. The victim's own conduct next. A man stabs a young woman who needs a blood transfusion to live. She is a Jehovah's Witness, refuses it, and dies. Does that break the chain? No. You take your victim as you find them, and that includes their beliefs. The Crown against Blau from 1975. And a young woman who jumps from a moving car to escape unwanted advances is doing something foreseeable, so her escape does not break the chain either. Third parties are the same story. A man who uses his pregnant girlfriend as a human shield while firing at police cannot complain when the police return fire and kill her. Their response was foreseeable, and lawful, and the thin skull rule runs through all of it. Take your victim as you find them, physical vulnerabilities and psychological ones alike. Mens rea now. Direct intention is easy. The defendant wants the result. The hard case is where he does not want it, but knows it is coming anyway. That is a bleak intention, and it matters most in murder, where nothing less than intention will do. The leading authority is the Crown against Woolen from 1999, where a man threw his three-month-old son onto a hard surface and the baby died. The direction has two limbs, and you need both. 1. Was death, or really serious harm, a virtual certainty from the defendant's act? 2. Did the defendant appreciate that it was? Answer yes to both, and the jury are entitled to find intention. Entitled, not obliged. It is a rule of evidence, not a definition of intention, and that distinction is worth marks. Recklessness is the level below, and it is subjective. The defendant must actually have foreseen the risk and unreasonably taken it anyway. The authority is the Crown against Cunningham from 1957, and the test still carries his name. A man tore a gas meter off a cellar wall to steal the money in it, and gas seeped next door, partially asphyxiating a sleeping woman. Maliciously held the court. Means he foresaw the risk of harm and took it. For a while, the law went the other way, with an objective test that asked what a reasonable person would have foreseen. Then, the Crown against G in 2003, where two boys aged 11 and 12 set fire to newspapers under a wheelie bin and burned down a shop. The House of Lords overruled the objective test. Recklessness is subjective. If the risk never crossed the defendant's mind, however obvious it was to everyone else, there is no recklessness. Transferred malice next. Aim at one victim, hit another, and the mens rea travels with the act. A man swings his belt at another man, it glances off and wounds a woman standing nearby, and the conviction stands. A man pushes into a post office queue, the man he shoves falls against an 89-year-old woman who breaks her leg and dies. And that is manslaughter. But the offense has to be of the same type. Throw a stone at a person, miss, and break a window instead, and the intention to assault does not become an intention to damage property. Malice transfers between victims. It does not transfer between offenses. Strict liability is the exception to the whole scheme. No mens rea required for at least one element, so a defendant who took every reasonable care can still be convicted. Rare at common law, common in regulatory statutes. And the starting point is a presumption against it. Where a statute creates an offence that is truly criminal rather than regulatory, the courts presume mens rea is required. The House of Lords made that presumption stick for a woman who let rooms in a farmhouse and knew nothing about her tenants smoking cannabis there. Her conviction went. To decide whether the presumption is displaced, look at four things. Is the offence truly criminal or regulatory? Does the statute use words like knowingly or maliciously? How severe is the penalty? And would requiring mens rea frustrate the purpose of the statute? Last, the two elements must coincide in time. Pick up an umbrella, genuinely believing it is yours, and decide to keep it only once you realize it is not, and that is not theft. There was no dishonesty at the moment of appropriation. The courts have softened that rule rather than abandoned it, and there are two escape routes. The first is the continuing act. A man drives onto a police officer's foot by accident, is told to move, and refuses. The application of force continues for as long as the car sits there, so the intention he forms catches up with it. Battery. The second is the single transaction. Men beat a victim, believe they have killed him, and roll him over a cliff to fake an accident. He dies of exposure. One transaction, and the men's rear runs through it. A word on how SQE1 tests this. You will not be asked to name a case or quote a section number. You get a scenario, 5 answers, and 1 instruction. Pick the best one. So learn the rules and how they decide facts. The names in this episode are memory pegs, nothing more, if you keep only 3. Wilmington and DPP for the golden thread, which is the default answer to any question about who proves what. The crown against Woolen for the 2 limbs of oblique intention. And the crown against G, because recklessness is subjective, and a risk the defendant never saw is no risk at all. 4 traps the examiners set. 1. Automatism has to be total. Impaired control is not enough. And a defendant who brought the state on himself with drink or drugs has no defense to a crime of basic intent, however completely he had lost control by the end. 2. Read the recklessness facts carefully. If the question tells you that a reasonable person would have seen the risk, but the defendant did not, there is no recklessness. The old objective test is gone. What matters is what was in this defendant's mind. 3. Transferred malice does not cross offense types. It moves the mens rea from the intended victim to the actual one, and no further. Intent to assault a person cannot become intent to damage property, and not the other way round either. 4. With omissions, never jump to the duty. Start with the general rule that a failure to act is not an actus reus. Then, name the source of the duty and say why it applies on these facts. A question with a sympathetic victim and no duty is testing exactly that.
Quick check.
A man heavily in debt decides to sink his fishing boat and claim on the insurance. 12 miles out at sea, at night, he opens the sea valves and leaves in the tender. 2 of his crew are asleep in the forward cabin. He has removed the life raft, the water is cold enough to kill within 20 minutes, and he knows neither man can survive. He does not want them to die. Both drown. Can he be convicted of their murder? 3 candidate answers. 1. No, because he did not want them to die, and intention means acting in order to bring a result about. 2. Yes, if the jury find he appreciated that their deaths were virtually certain. 3. Yes, because a reasonable person would have foreseen that the crew would drown. Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is 2. Where the defendant does not act in order to kill, the jury may still find the intention murder requires. 2 conditions, death or really serious harm, was a virtual certainty, and he appreciated that it was. Both are satisfied. The life raft was gone, the water was lethal, and he knew neither man could survive. Why the others fail? One defines intention too narrowly. Wanting the result is direct intention, and not the only kind. 3 swaps in an objective test, which is not the law for intention. And notice the word if in answer 2. The jury are entitled to find intention, not obliged to. 5 things to take away. 1. The prosecution proves every element beyond reasonable doubt, and on most offences, the defendant only has to raise the issue. 2. The actus reus must be voluntary, and a failure to act counts only where a legal duty exists. 3. Causation needs both limbs, and intervening acts almost never break the chain. 4. Oblique intention means virtual certainty plus the defendant's appreciation of it, and the jury are entitled, not obliged, to find it. 5. Recklessness is subjective, and the actus reus and mens rea must coincide, whether by a continuing act or a single transaction. And our lifeguard walks away because nothing made the man her responsibility. Ask where the duty comes from before you ask anything else. Next time, common assault and battery. Practice this topic with exam-style questions at sqe1prep.co.uk. This episode is for education and exam revision only, not legal advice, and we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the SRA or Kaplan.